That's why I'm all in bed. Nobody gives me sympathy.
Hello, and welcome back to our podcast, but a fanfic of a fanfic that itself is a synthesis of Fallout, the popular game about a post-apocalyptic wasteland, and My Little Pony, a popular show about pastel horses. I'm never going to pronounce apocalyptic right the first time through. Hi once again, I'm Fi. I'm joined once again with our co-host Weird. Say hello, Weird.
Well, I would if you would ever get my name correct. That is Sir Weirdington Esquire.
Yeah.
A title I fought very hard to grant myself by my own divine right.
He is king of the jukeboxes. Somewhere out there is a graveyard of jukeboxes.
What?
There.
No, merely an esquire. Not even king of the jukeboxes. Good heavens! I'm not even a lord!
Alright, my mistake. Hey, so welcome back once again. We're on a big chapter this week. It's a big heavy chapter. We're finally making it back to Stable 99, where we're meeting up with old friends and having a fun adventure. We're on chapter 22, folks. So you know, Weird. Hey, what did we learn last week that led us into this one?
Well, our odyssey aboard the Seaman. Was tragically brief. We learned that spooky hench folk, the diamond dogs of the original series, have since become sand dogs after being turned into a Native American genocide XP.
Yes, that is a thing that they do.
So now they're like starving cyborgs. Because this is just so incredibly edgy. They're commissioned by a town of ponies to go kill them all.
Yeah, that's what they were doing.
But our party is commissioned to go butcher the last of them. But in a startling out of character act, they actually talk to the sand dogs. Arrange some sort of reconciliation
between the two camps.
Incredibly formulaic, but you know, at least out of character for what we can usually expect.
Huzzah, racism is now defeated. To the power of trade.
Yeah, because commerce makes people less hostile to each other.
Yes. Scarcity does in fact, you know, somehow make everybody want to come together and help and not kill each other. Artificial scarcity, doubly so.
Well, it's not, you know, mind you, not collaboration and sharing, but the competition of a market. Why share when you can ransom resources
trade
to each
for
other?
Money. And you can establish a market where people have to trade their valuables to live another week.
Yeah, nothing quite so pro-social as ransom. Let's see here. Yeah, a bunch of not really interested, like some sightseeing on the journey, and they finally arrive. Going to finally reunite with all the people we used to know. And oh wait, when we left, this place was being like ransacked. was being like sieged and breached by cannibal zombies and their sociopathic overlords. And so virtually everybody is dead except for the Overmayor, who through almost certainly some kind of profoundly Faustian bargain, remains yet alive and in control of the intercom system.
Yeah. That's not quite right, but that gives me a good lead into talk about our new chapter, though.
Well, first, what perk did we earn from our sea voyage?
Oh, shit. What did we learn? What did we earn? Learn in the urn. We got light trot, which makes you less susceptible to tripping up trip wires and traps and pressure explosives and stuff because they did all that, like, bomb disarmal, disarming last episode. So yeah, it's kind of a milquetoast one. Okay. Whatever. Not even anything really to yell about in this one. So that does lead us into chapter 22, though. So, first of all, content warning for basically the entire chapter. There's a lot of gore. There's a lot of cannibalism. Can you have a light? A moderate amount of rape.
Implicit rape, I guess, would qualify as product contains moderate rape.
Yeah. So, like, if you want to sit this chapter out, I don't mind. There'll be another chapter like this coming up in a few weeks that I also feel that you could just probably just skip entirely if you don't feels like it agrees with you.
That's your freedom. Take advantage of your freedoms. Take advantage.
Yeah,
of...
we're just bolted to the floor, and I have to do this. My brain won't let me. But yeah, so we open up into a scene that I actually like, and I like it despite it being bad and stupid. But we open up with a really cool, but admittedly goofy. Like, you have to be on board, I guess, to enjoy the scene. Is the point I'm making? But anyways, to not dawdle too much, we open up with a scene where BJ is, like, you know, braced with the horror of literally everyone that she's known apparently is now gone raider, and she, like, ruminates on, like, the all of her, like, basically the theme that's been building up in this story up to this point, that if she has a virtue, it's death. Which is edgy as shit, I know, but and she's like, well, if the wasteland's gonna make me into an executioner, I'm going to be a fucking executioner. We're then treated to an interesting sort of soiree where BJ is going through this almost, it feels almost slow motion crawl of her charging into her former, like, stable and shooting people. And it's described in such a way that, like, we're given, like, the tally of, like, you know, shot into, you know, whatever, like, blue, oh, that's Bluebell, and then, like, rattling off who she was. And, like, oh, and this is fairy dust, and rattling off who she was. And I kind of like that as, like, an interesting, like sort of prose of, like, these are people she's being forced to kill for fucked up reasons, but, like, it's still really cool. What's a lot goofier, though, about this is the fact that this is also, I don't know poetry very well, but this is also interspersed with a poem, which is going to be in the show notes, and I'm not going to read it in full, but it's a ponified version of a William Blake, like, poem. So, like, just keep that in mind.
Edge! The Marquise, oh, yeah, of Edge!
But yeah, it'll be in the show notes, but just trust me on this. It's fucking hilarious. But yeah, she this gunfight goes on for a very long time, like multiple pages. And she doesn't really do much of a dent in them because they're all well supplied, healthy, just raidered. So she really can't do much to them, for the most part. And she's severely outgunned. There's kind of a fun scene where she eventually does get it, like, sort of completely overwhelmed by this. And there's a huge blur of chaos where she's getting beat on by her former family, and we hear, like, shouts of her of the crew, like, trying to rescue her from whatever's happening, and then, like, the scene transitions as she's basically completely overwhelmed by, like, the mass of raider-fied zombie ponies. And that's how we open our chapter. is with BJ being pretty much dead. Anywho, scene transitioned into Blackjack being in a near-death coma state, where she's hallucinating, like, all of her friends talking about trying to save her, but none of their voices match up with their bodies, and it keeps oscillating into different people, and it's just a weird hallucinatory scene. Where all this is happening, she then wakes up to finding out that the gang's kind of okay. Like, a couple of them have gone missing, but they've been rescued by Lake. So, like, way, way back in Chapter 1, we're greeted to a small gang of named characters. One of them is Rivets, the chief engineer, and one of them is Midnight, a pit-buck technician. And apparently they're one of the very small contingent of folks that, like, didn't get raider-fied by, like, the events that was happening, and they've been, like, living in some of the quarters, and they've been, like, defending themselves from the rest of the stable proper as they've been going nuts. Because apparently, like, this came in waves where, like, no one knew what was going on, and apparently the Overmare got affected first, and she spread it to everybody else, really. And now she's in total control of the stable, and they need to win it back from the Overmare. But they have a plan B. So back in the day, before the males were made into slaves, the incident that was happening with that, males tried to threaten breaking the air filtration system by using a talisman that has been modified to poison the stable. So their plan B is, if we can't fix this raider shit, we're gonna have to just gas the stable by turning all the oxygen in the filtration system into chlorine gas. But they're like, oh, well, hopefully it doesn't come to that. We're gonna try and kill the Overmare first. So what plan A is ends up being fucking ridiculous and insane. So I've talked about it multiple times in the story that, like, most of BJ's plans, for whatever reason, just involve disguises a lot, and they work most of the time for whatever reason. BJ's plan in this case is one of the security they have one of the bodies of one of the security ponies that have gotten raided, named Marmalade. She's from Chapter 1. So the plan is to dress like Marmalade and wear some of Marmalade's skin so that they can disguise with the raiders so that she can get to the Overmare system and install the talisman. And all that jazz. So that's the plan. Oh, this chapter's fucking ridiculous, by the way.
So I don't know that my brain was able to, like,
internalize any of that.
They're going to Shaun of the Dead their way through the zombie hordes.
Yeah, specifically Blackjack is.
Okay.
She's going to disguise herself as Marmalade and get through and get to the other side. Yeah.
Disguise herself as a specific zombie.
Yeah, pretty much. Well, raiders aren't zombies. Like, I keep saying that, but, like, it's the problem where it's, like, it's basically treated like a zombie plague, but the zombies are smart. It is basically what raiders are in this story.
Okay.
Like, they're cannibals and they're evil, but they're still conscious. But, anyway, so scene transition into BJ enacting the plan. There's a lot that happens here that I kind of just get to cut out, which is exciting. Where it's a lot of BJ, like, interacting with a bunch of the cannibal raiders and getting past them, and then she finds in the cafeteria what's become of Rampage. Rampage has basically been hooked to a table, and they're using her as like an inexhaustible buffet. Because she'll just regenerate any of the organs that have been pulled out of her, so they're just, like, gorging themselves on Rampage's body. And Rampage is just apparently in a state of, like, pure catatonia while this is happening. The only important part of this happening is that BJ gets caught by Daisy, the, like, other member of security that, like, she knew and was friends with as a kid. And apparently Daisy doesn't see through the disguise. Maybe? But she, like, pulls a purity test on her anyways of, like, well, you know, if you're a cannibal, you'll certainly eat this heart. So there's, like, a scene of just Rampage's heart getting eaten out by Blackjack. That's a thing that's happening now.
Okay. Yeah, no, that super had to happen.
Yep. Super had to happen. Like I said, folks can just skip this chapter.
Edge. Just edging we're not so done yet. Hard. Look how edgy
we're edging so hard we're breaking off into negative edge. But anyways, she manages to sneak past them. She finds Lacuna, who's been tied up by a couple of the raiders, but they can't, like, do anything to her because she can just, you know, melt them with her fucking magic. she frees Lacuna from her Raider stables, Popes. But Lacuna is basically like, she's being talked to by the goddess, and the goddess is like, you know, fucking, we just need to get, like, I'm just gonna get out of the situation. Fuck this shit. I'm out. You people can go get eaten on yourselves. But Lacuna doesn't want to, because she wants to help BJ. So BJ, like, basically makes a deal with her that's like, well, I'll help you find that book if you help us get out of this situation. And the goddess is kind of just like, fine, but I'll hold you to that deal. So Lacuna bounces them out of that location into a different part that's closer to the Overmare's, like, location. And then she basically BJ makes the plan, Lacuna, like, split up, go save the males from the medical wing, and go get all the guns from the armory, and I'll meet back with you. So BJ's on her own to face down the Overmare. On to my second page of notes. Exciting, folks. BJ finds the Overmare and P21 in a compromised situation, because the Overmare is fucking raping 21. Because that's the thing that the Overmare used to do, apparently. Before he left, 21 was like her like primary fuck toy, basically. So she's glad to have him back. BJ fights the Overmare for a while. We learn that the Overmare's pointless tragic backstory, where she was raped by her own mother, and that's why like she's damaged, and she killed her own mother, and that's why she like became like a tin pot fascist, is that she never wanted anyone to hurt her ever again.
Sure.
Yeah, like it just doesn't matter. Like I don't care.
And she's already like Knight of the Comets at this point, so like,
yeah.
Is B-21 going to be inexplicably like free and safe from like zombietosis? Like it's,
yeah.
Okay.
Yes. So for folks that don't know, I looked into this, and the closest thing that this is like basically mad cow disease, and like fluid transfer is a really easy way to like get this sort of thing, and you can absolutely like anything that is like a like as far as I've been given to understand, anything that is like blood transmissible, which this disease certainly is also like sexually fluid transmissible as well. So like he should have the Raider disease now. But he doesn't, because it's, you know, whatever. This is a nitpick in a story, but like it's a thing of like, it sucks when like there's no opportunity to capitalize on that, like, oh, this could be a problem. It's like, but it's not going to be. It's never going to be.
Yeah, because 21 is really great when you're realistic, edgy, serious. Entertainment product, your super edgy, super serious story doesn't, you know, give a shit about consequences.
Yeah. That's the word I'm looking for, is consequences. Especially with 21, because like
his baggage anyway. Like he doesn't
do anything important in the story. But yeah, anyways, BJ and Overmare have a fight to a sort of standstill, and then 21 does the old slave turning on their master moment of like wrapping the chain that they've been like secured to the floor with around the Overmare's neck and then choking her to death. And it's really graphic about it, like obviously it is, but like I don't know, like graphic choking always really fucks me up. Maybe it's just because of my broken lungs.
I mean, just remember that it's a like early aughts Flash cartoon. Like that should help.
Yeah.
Like
But like, see, I don't know if that makes that worse though, because I feel like a Flash horse like going purple over several breathless minutes is also pretty horrible to imagine.
Honestly, like it taking like that long to like painstaking like the entire run of a Newgrounds clip to strangle a horse, pastel horse to death sounds like Discordian comedy gold.
Yeah, it's juxtaposition is where it's hilarious. But like that's the thing, is like choking people takes a long time. It takes a really long time for someone to actually die from suffocating. So like it's just one of those things where it would have to be like a long video. It'd have to be a long, drawn-out thing.
And I am imagining it, and I almost want to make it real. Like, the Kaufman-esque, like, prank on the audience sort of humor of it. Of, like, it just keeps going. like her eyes rolling back in her head, like she doesn't make any sound for like a good 3 seconds, and you think it's finally over, but nope, she like starts gasping and like waving her little like flat like blocky hooves around again.
Oh, that's so dark. That's gonna give me nightmares. Oh Christ, we're not even like 20% into this fucking chapter. Anyways, they're like, yeah, you know, we got the mail safe, we got the guns, we can take back the stable, we cut off the head, we can kill the rest of the body. And this is the part of my notes where I wrote, if ponies could slow clap, Daisy would have walked into the room doing so, because this is the moment in the fiction where the real villain is revealed and goes, oh, thanks for killing my boss so I didn't have to do so. I also am evil and want to kill everyone. But, like, it doesn't really matter because, like, Daisy's been, like, uniformly a monster.
Yeah, and also, like, yeah, sure, and you are next. Like, we were going to systematically remove all the, like, monstrous zombies. Like,
so, yeah, no, good job.
Yeah, yeah, thanks for coming to us while we're at the height of our power.
But we have all the guns. Anyways, we actually get, like, in my opinion, keep this in mind, an interesting fight scene. It's I wrote this as a real slobber knocker of a battle between BJ and Daisy, because they fucking take chunks out of each other for a huge chunk of this chapter. But I like the thing I specifically think that is interesting about it is they both immediately go into the goofy Zawardo sats at the same time. So there's kind of a fun, like, okay, like, how does this actually work if both people are using it at the same time in a fight moment? And there's a lot of goofy chicanery between them when they're fighting. BJ gets Daisy to chase her around the stable for a while, taking chunks out of her. It takes absolute hell to actually kill her. Along the time, there's snippets of BJ being like, I wanted to save you. And Daisy's like, you only made it worse by, like, you know, trying to arrest my mom. Like, what did you think was going to happen? BJ's like, well, what could I do? And she's like, well, kill me or kill my mother. That would have been the way to fix it. And this is where we get, like, a big theme of this fucking story, where Daisy, who should not be uttering this, because bad guys, generally speaking, should not be your moral centers in your story, she exclaims, sometimes you have to kill the pony to save the pony. You have to kill the man to spare the man mentality. Because the story is a lot about, like, what I'm going to call black mercy. Like, the idea of, like, euthanasia is consistently, like, spread throughout this story. Especially with characters who are, like, supposedly too far gone. But yeah, Daisy's basically a melting skeleton by the time they kill her. We get a really goofy scene that, like, every time I read it over, is the kind of moment that I'm like, this is an anime moment. And what I mean by that is there's a bit, BJ says something along the lines of, like, oh, you know, we were friends once, and Daisy's like, fuck you. And then, like, every single member of the crew shows up and utters one line of a phrase that's basically like, oh, well, that's okay, because BJ's got friends in us now. We'll never, you know, we'll never betray each other. And it's the goofiest moment in this, like, this incredibly edgy chapter where basically they're like, oh, together we're better as friends, and just rainbow sparkles, and it's just like, what the fuck is this doing here?
Especially when, like, not too long ago, like, we did let you almost get killed by that gangster because we thought it was too funny that you were dumb.
Yeah, it's a weird moment. It's so jarring.
Also, one of us is a child killer. One of us kills babies.
Let's actually go down the tally. One of us is a child killer. One of them is a fascist that maybe invented, like, the worst biological plague ever. And Blackjack, you raped me, like, more than once, and killed my only lover. Like, did we just forget all that, I guess?
Friends to the end.
We're all friends. Real friends are the friends we made along the way. It's a bad moment. It's a terrible, terrible moment in the story. It's so jarring and scene killing. Anyways, boss defeated. Daisy is now a glowing skeleton of meat. Cue victory theme. They also dispatch most the other raiders, but it's handled in two sentences by this point, since everyone has their guns now and everyone's they've killed the only two members of actual note, the only two high level enemies in the area. But yay! So we get denouement time. We get into our cooldown phase.
I mean, wouldn't it be a bitch if the true final boss, the real the ultimate weapon of this dungeon was Scruffy the janitor?
I'm actually level 99 this whole time. God, that would be funny. But anyways, denouement time. We're now in the chill thing. We've saved the day. We've saved the stable from itself. BJ and Glory chat a while about the nature of the Raider disease. They ascertain that maybe the Raider disease makes you more loyal to an authority figure, perhaps, because it would explain why the Raiders, despite being conscious, free thinking entities that just have to eat people now, or were weirdly subservient to the Overmare in a way they were never before. Which, since speculation is always inherently true in a piece of fiction, of course that's true. BJ blames herself for the stable, and Glory has to, play emotional labor doctor for a while by saying it's not your fault. There's no way you could have prevented this from happening. There's no way you could have prevented Daisy from happening. This isn't your fault. Which, I mean, kind of isn't. It wasn't exactly her fault. It was mostly the Overmares in a lot of cases. Maybe for once. This ends with a scene with BJ and Glory smooching much more passionately than they did last time, and BJ being more accepting of Glory's advances this time round. We get a scene I'm going to completely skip, which is literally a lesbian Sarah scene that's in this, which is a callback to the first chapter's first paragraph about a lesbian Sarah scene. But just imagine imagine horrible softcore Bloom and just shitty jazz music playing.
I refuse. How about that?
Well, you can refuse. Anyways, yeah, characters fuck, whatever. On to my third page of notes. There's a little bit of a mention about the joke of where'd you learn how to do that, Glory? And then apparently 21 and Rampage has been giving their friend sex tips behind BJ's back. It's also where we find out that Glory is mega gay, and she mentioning about being weird in the sky because they're sky fascists and they're weird about homosexuality in general, and she was worried that she didn't want to turn out one of her older sisters. This is interesting to me, but it isn't really interesting to the story. It gives Glory some much needed character that isn't just sky fascist or sky lib. But anyways, we transition to a couple of days later, where BJ and 21 are having a frank conversation, where 21 has managed to chat with the males and is having issues with trying to sway them over from the old system. They're just too well conditioned over the circumstances of their life, so they're just kind of expecting everything to go back to normal and then to go back to being toys. And at least one of them is preaching the idea that, well, I actually loved the breeding rotation, and I don't want that to ever change. So and they're just kind of 21 is feeling glum because it's he kind of expected the to charge in and be the hero and convince all the males to leap into freedom like he has, but it's just kind of given the cold shoulder, and everyone just sort of wants them to leave so they can go back to the normal stable system that they had before. The sentiment is redoubled by Midnight, who is the pit buck technician, who finally helps BJ unlock the coordinates for the the Maltese.exe and like shows her next location, which is a like essentially a radio tower that's off in the distance that they have to go check out. And she kind of just like makes a scoff at Blackjack. He's like, "Well, so when are you leaving?" And BJ's like, "Well, like this is my home too." And Midnight's like, "Well, is it?" And it's and I don't know. It's a clumsy. It's the thing at the end of the hero's journey where like the hero realizes they can never really come back home because they've changed so much that home is not really home anymore. But yeah, so everyone just getting alienated by the stable's general feeling. We jump forward a couple more days, and they are now completely ghosted by the entirety of the stable's population. Everyone's avoiding them. The only conversations that BJ can seem to have is with her regular crew. She fights with Rivets, who's now become the de facto leader of the stable, that like the stable is broken beyond repair and they have to like move into the wastes. They don't have a choice anymore. Like apparently there was like they found in the Overmare's office that there was a report that basically like the stable had literally like 2 years left before it would just utterly catastrophizedly break and they would just die in the stable. But Rivets basically just like gets really mad at her and just says like, "I think you need to leave. Like, you know, we've done fine before and we'll do fine again. Like we need to just hunker down and make the stable great again. We don't need to open our borders with the outside." Very, very paranoid nonsense.
Well, wait a minute. Who is the chief engineer, if not Rivets?
Oh, Rivets is. Rivets is the chief engineer. She's now the de facto leader of the stable, though. Because she's the only, like...
Okay. Who wrote this report?
She did, theoretically? I don't know. It doesn't say who wrote the report, just that there was a report.
Okay.
Yeah, I didn't even think about that.
I will now defy my own advice, my own assessment.
Because I'm that much of an asshole. story's dumb. VJ finally gets some time to actually fucking grieve over her mother, which I kind of like, where she's going through her mother's things and is kind of like having a moment where she sort of like learns of the hidden depths of her own mother that she never really realized. Like that her mother was like something of an artist and all the friends that she had and all the people that she knew, and like finding a bunch of like keepsakes and memorabilia that like could be traced down from the original people that ran the security in the stable. She finds her mother's old gun, which is an inherited gun from every it's the like symbol of the badge of that you are the chief of security. It's a gun named Vigilance that has like every security head's name carved into it, and she kind of like breaks up when she realizes that her birth name Go Fish is written into the bottom of it. I don't know. It's a scene I like. Like for all the shit that I mock of this story, I kind of like this like deeply humanizing moment of both Blackjack and her mother. And it might be tacky amongst all this gore, but fuck it.
And the stats are bawling. It has an enormous DPS modifier.
That too. It does a lot of damage. It does the big numbers. Oh man. So, anyways,
you know what would have been an interesting, like bittersweet, like self-aware, poking fun at itself, but also potentially, if you did it right, morally impactful thing, is if it turns out the stats kind of suck. Like the gun would have been pretty good like 3 guns ago, or maybe even just 2 guns ago, but like to really hammer home the like you can't go back home again, like hey, you finally got your family heirloom weapon and like
it's a level one sword.
No, you've ground past it. It's a level 20 sword, but you're now like 25. Like it is just like it is only just like a little while ago passed out of the cycle of big number.
Yeah, I don't know. I still like it as a sentimental memento though. So I'll take what I can get. Damn it. Anyways, now we're getting into the dumb stuff. So they wake up the next morning with a petition that has been like basically nailed. It's been carefully pinned to BJ's door that says we of the of Stable 99 signed this petition to ask you to politely leave the premises within the next day. And there's a huge like mob of signatures that have been written down on it. So BJ has that like one final moment of realization that she's being like properly exiled from her stable, and she'll never be able to come back again. So she like kind of packs up the things that she can for tomorrow. The next day, this is where my like notes unfortunately end, but I remember this chapter so well it doesn't matter. We open up with the next chapter. We open up the next day with her. Well, not next day. It's like the middle of the night because like BJ's like sleep schedule's fucked up. As she admits, because she worked the night shift. So she wanders around the halls. She finds some boxes of memorabilia that have been like that came out of storage. From the ponies that were trying to survive in the living quarters, that trace back to Taro, one of the original like security officers, and the original one, which is Card Trick, which only really matters for a really important part of the backstory later. But just know that like you know, Taro is a character from a previous thing that is now that ended up in the stable somehow. But anyways, as she's you know wandering the halls, melancholic, and like she. She hears, like, you know, the banging and swearing of some small child, which she bumps into a member of the engineering staff, and she's like, oh, you know, who are you? And he's like, oh, I'm Scotch Tape. I took over for my daughter, my mother, who was duct tape really, really early into the story. And they're like, well, what are you doing? He's like, well, the pipes bust. He's like, what do you mean the pipes bust? He's like, well, they fed a bunch of extra bodies into the system, and that overloaded it, and it's all broken now. And that's when BJ has the dawning realization of, like, those are all bodies that are filled with the Raider disease. And those bodies have been in here for days. And that means that the whole food system... It's important to note specifically that none of the main crew, obviously, had been eating any of the stable food. Since it's all dry, you know, soylent green chips. But the entire stable has been eating nothing but Raider-poisoned, diseased food for... 4 or 5 days now, so every single member except for this one child, because she admits that she's been eating some stolen canned food for the last couple of days, every single member of the stable is infected with the Raider disease now.
Man, that Raider virus is really potent when it wants to be. Like,
oh, it's convenient if it could, like that.
Yeah, if it can survive all the way through like a like pasteurization into corn chips.
Apparently.
So anyway, hey kid, want to go on an adventure?
Yeah, basically. That's basically what happens. Hey child, you've been added to the party. But everybody else has got to go.
Otherwise, I'm adding you to my inventory.
Scotch tape has been added to the inventory. I'm much like that, honestly.
Very dumb. But, okay.
But yeah. So BJ goes to Rivets and is like, okay, you've poisoned the whole fucking stable. And Rivets is like, nah, nonsense. Those things get filtered out. And BJ is like, no, it can get into literally anything. And then realizes that Rivets has been has some of the telltale signs of Raiderism, because the Raiders chew on themselves when they can't eat something. So like she's covered in her like bite marks and she's got blood in her teeth. But yeah, so that happens. She runs back to the crew, and they're like, okay, well, what do we do about this? Well, we can't. We need to seal the stable. Like, they can't get out. Like, we're gonna unload literally hundreds of perfectly healthy but raiderified raiders out into the waste. Like, that'll cause a catastrophe. And they're like, well, we had that plan B with the chlorine gas. And BJ's like, all right, so here's the plan. Everyone's going to leave. I'm gonna get into the Overmare station, like station, hook up the thing into the filtration, hit the button, and run it as fast as I can. So the pals, the BJ friends, the BJ crew, all exit the building while BJ decides to stay behind. And this is when we the audience get revealed what BJ's actual plan is that she knows she needs to make sure that this is going to go off without a hitch. So she's not going to leave the stable and she's going to die with the rest of the stable. So we get a pretty horrible graphic scene as BJ is like hits the button and all the air starts flooding out with chlorine gas. And like I was like looking at the symptoms of like chlorine gas before we started this podcast. Chlorine gas is bad. Like it's a bad way to die.
Melts your lungs, doesn't it?
Yep. Your lungs fill up with blood. You can't stop coughing and wheezing. Your eyes burn. Literally every part of like all your skin burns. Like it's just it's gruesome, agonizing death that is primarily through suffocation on your own lungs. So we're treated to a bunch of ponies doing that, and Midnight, like, you know, sort of like in a last breath of hell heart, I spit at thee, calls Blackjack a murderer just before she keels over, and BJ does the whole like I you know I'm ready to like, accept death, I'm tired of living. I'll do this one last execution and go along with it. And at the last second, fucking Lacuna bamps in with the voice of the goddess going, "We had a deal, Blackjack," and scoops her up in her arms and bamps out of the stable with a BJ screaming furiously the entire time. And that's how our chapter ends.
Wait a minute. No, that doesn't explain how she gets back into the dungeon. But like I'm just trying to imagine there's still some sort of like actual logic behind when and when she can and cannot teleport.
We
joked that it was basically escape rope, like that.
Yeah. But no, apparently she can do it. She can do it 3 times per day now, I guess.
Okay, sure.
And it's modified by her charisma score or whatever.
Okay.
But yeah, BJ killed a whole stable.
Yeah.
Of evil fascists that were raping the men.
And also the victims.
Yeah, and also the victims.
Yeah, that was all super necessary.
Yeah. Yay. BJ is a war criminal. Yay. I'm just going to say yay a lot.
I mean, like, I should have known. I should have felt my like that, like, no, it's not a not like, like a let's say normal storyteller instincts would just be to like have it that like, all right, you can't go back home again. And so the sort of bitter, like you've come back, you more or less saved it, but like now that it's just a thing that's been left behind you, they're just going to like they've squandered their chances, and they're gonna rot like behind you, and maybe like you can come again sometime from now to find it empty. And full of mummies, maybe just a sad, bitter day, a true tragedy. But nope. Blackjack has to take final vengeance and slaughter them all on the way out the door. How are we going to justify that? Oh, they're so stupid. They dump like diseased corpses into their cannibalism vats.
Yes, they did. I mean, at the very least, BJ knew this was unforgivable and decided to take herself out along the way. Like, she wasn't going to get scot-free out of this one. BJ don't make it out of this chlorine gas. But yeah, oh, fuck, this chapter is fucking... This chapter's nuts, though. Like,
that was the end of it?
Yeah, that was the end of it. Lacuna bouncing her out.
So I think I definitely have to say that more couch psychoanalyzing. More backseat making extrapolations about our author. Or at least, like... At least the like sort of picture of the author, this story like paints the like sort of the message of the story and the way it's told. So like normally, part of a normal storyteller, what you usually like when you present your villains is kind of right. Normally, that you do this so that by the end of the story. They are proven wrong. You normally present your villains like point of views in a positive light to begin with, so that like so as to Iron Man the position, so that like the protagonists part of their change to the story is initially believing what the villain believes, but like the arc, the growth is surmounting that,
it's like the villain, like typically you'd see it with the villains who are like, oh well, having friends is stupid, only in isolation can one go strong, like you have to kill your way to the top, and then like the hero is like, nah, friends are awesome actually, and then he beats the bad guy through the power of friendship. Like that's a pretty bog standard example.
Also, the best way to learn this sort of lesson is to see an example of it not working, like sucking, like being like so like the Dark Knight has a lot of problems, like its politics are pretty bullshit, but one thing it's got going for it is at least like it the Joker is like defeated by being proven wrong, at least in terms of the boats, like, aha, everybody's just as hideous as me, so of course they'll blow each other up. But, like, it's the, like, boat full of prisoners that, like, the one that, you know, supposedly is the more likely to have no principles and pull the trigger, like, throws the detonator out of the window. And so, like, Gotham proves the Joker wrong. is an example of this going right. An example of this going wrong is Endgame is kind of horseshit, and it makes me deeply angry because it never confronts Thanos's like beliefs. It never like demonstrates that Thanos is wrong.
Ignore it and tiptoe around it.
Thanos's like point of view is fundamentally never proven wrong. Like, only in that, like, the only way in which Thanos is wrong is the hardship his insane like implementation causes, and that the heroes like rebel against, but not that, like, it's never shown that, like, oh yeah, this never would have worked, like that this was a foolhardy thing to do. His core goals, like, he sacrificed, like, the thing that I was expecting watching like Infinity War was that Endgame would display that Thanos is wrong because his goals would never be met. Like, he sacrificed his daughter, himself, and half of the galaxy for nothing.
Yes.
But
provably nothing too.
But instead, like, oh, the whale populations are doing better. Like, yeah. So that's an example of like dropping the ball on like repudiating the villain. In this, I have two concurrent theories for why, like, oh no, like, we actually look, we become the villain, and we're better for it. Like, oh no, it turns out, yes, the villain was right, and in becoming more like them,
the villain was right, they were just weak. We killed them, we took their ideologies with our stronger morals, and we're better for it.
So, two things. One... Randianism is just sort of like profound, like it's extraordinary. There's like, if you go to the Ayn Rand lexicon, you can look up things like the sanction of the victim, which can be boiled down to empathy is a dark temptation. That like Randians, like hardcore like objectivists, tend to associate empathy and forget, like, compassion, like pro-social emotions, as just as wicked a temptation, a thing to be resisted, as a normal person would associate greed or murderous hate.
Like, yeah, they assume that guilt is basically a form of mind control. That the only reason why, like a victim is essentially exerting power over their oppressor by guilting them and publicly shaming them for their actions, and that as an Ubermensch, you should ignore those feelings because they're only holding you back.
So there's that, and combined with fascistic disavowal, that, like, okay, I, the author, want to espouse a moral, a dark enlightenment moral, like I want to espouse my moral theory, but I'm aware that the general collective consciousness on this issue is firmly against me, and that traditional media depicts people like me as monsters, because we are. and so in order to like express this idea, I can only express it through what would traditionally be seen as a villain, as an opposing force.
It's where you get your villain sues a lot of the time.
And so this is like, that's that, I think that is my working art theory. That is my working like critical theory, as to explain why this keeps happening in Project Horizons.
The author believes things but knows that they're like not socially acceptable to believe them, and so has to like bury them in like
disavowal that like,
yeah,
no, it's bad. Look, the villain believes it, which sort of hushes over that the hero like internalizes it. It becomes what the hero also believes.
Specifically, the hero exemplifies it. There is I'm gonna talk into it in really big detail when we get there. But there is like, and I've been hinting this a lot, but there's a incredibly like worrying line that comes from Blackjack. Contextualizing, I've talked about this before, actually, in a previous chapter as well, that, like, the author seems to genuinely believe that, like, things like self-destructive, like, urges are positive if they're directed towards a positive end goal. Like, well, I want to die, but I will die for my country, so that's a good thing, is a theme that's part of this story. It's just so deeply muddied with a whole bunch of other shit that's, like it's why like a like it's always weird having conversations with people who like who are fans of this because they don't get it, and I've talked about this multiple times through this fucking podcast at this point, but like they don't see the like terrifying inner workings of a lot of the work. Like someone had an argument with me about how like they hated Blackjack but they liked the story, and I couldn't wrap my brain around that because like I forget that for a lot of people characters are real. And but what I mean by that is that, like, this isn't a story being written by Somber. This is a live
folk
retelling. Yeah. This is an account of actual events as dreamed up by Somber. Like, he's a journalist, not a writer. And in that perspective, Blackjack is a terribly unlikable person because they're just awful and mean and crude and crass and childish. And those details are really annoying in real people. But, like, I don't necessarily care about those things because, like, they contribute to a theme of a character that's kind of going somewhere, which is the part I enjoy about her. There's a slip off the rails at some point, but, like, there is a feeling about Blackjack being a character who is learning to be a better person, starting off from a deeply broken and, troubled not even childhood, because like this chapter just revealed a bunch of shit that was like her child was like pretty awesome, honestly. She's just a failure. The problem is that like her being crass and annoying and goofy and extremely gay is like fun character elements that I find enjoyable about her, but I can easily find are annoying for other people. But it's weird to me that like the cutting line is this would be really annoying in a person, therefore I hate this character, not there's a reason why this character is like this, and I should accept that. Mm. But yeah, overarchingly, the themes of the story are worryingly problematic, and also it's worrying that they're mostly being vocalized by the villains. And to some degree, I do think I kind of agree with your vibe. I think the problem is I think Somber is just honestly just an inarticulate writer, and like cannot decide, like, It's this like paradoxical double think where like, so in My Little Pony, the show is all about friendship, and it's all about like people coming together and saving the day through collective action and like, you know, learning to overcome each other's like weird eccentricities and learning to become better people. And Fall Equestria is largely about like a world in which all that stuff died and they're trying to put that back together. Like a big thing about a big lore thing that contributes to the theme of this in Fallout Equestria is that and I talked about this in a previous chapter, obviously, but the elements of harmony, the big MacGuffins that solve the problem every week in the original show, don't work anymore because the characters, like the characters that exemplified their elements, lost that at some point in during the industrialization and militarization of their fascist government, and they changed as people and became people that were incapable of exemplifying those elements. It became like gray shadows of those former selves. And a lot about what FOE is about like reclaiming those elements so that they can maybe fix this problem. Like they actually physically, for plot reasons, cannot fix the wasteland's radioactive hellscape problem without reuniting the elements of Harmony. That is just physically impossible. So a huge chunk of the story is dedicated to the idea of like trying to find found friends and trying to like, you know, fix the fucking problem by coming together. And the problem with Project Horizons is it feels to some degree like Somber went, that's baby shit, and like wanted to write a story where all the characters were darker and edgier and more damaged and broken, without getting that like the core theme of friendship was still preserved in FOE for all of its darkness and edginess. And that makes for a work that is fucking at odds with itself all the time, because like there's tons of instances where the story wants to pander to the original source material, but doesn't get the themes that were like presented in the original source material. Or maybe he understands them, but doesn't think that they're good, so he like tries to work around them in a lot of cases. Like, BJ is so weirdly Ubermensch in a bunch of ways, and a lot of the cast has like nothing to do in the like main drive of the story. Like, almost none of them matter. Like, 21 doesn't matter. Rampage doesn't matter. Lacuna barely matters. Fucking Scotch Tape also doesn't matter. The new hire. Glory kind of matters because her family, like her family's a position of statesmanship. But even in just like the nitty gritty day to day, like I reran the story in my head at some point. I don't think a single person is killed by anyone besides Blackjack in the story that is named. Like, none of them. No single important character is ever defeated by anyone besides Blackjack. And at that point, what is the point of having any of your characters do anything? Like, they're skill loadouts and mental baggage, and that's it. And it's just, it's a disservice to, like, even the kind of shitty characters you've created here. Like, Glory is a horrible fascist neolib that's, like, coming around to it, but even she has her sort of fun quirks, but they're, like, wasted on her inability to do anything that contributes to the story. And same goes for all of the rest, the whole cast. It's a sitcom where the story never really turns the camera off of the protagonist. Gets really frustrating a lot of the time.
Oh, well. So, to all you listening, give us your hearts. Lend us your power through hearts and thumbs up and stars.
And likes and things. You can find me on Thou Art Fi on fucking Twitter and fucking Mastodon.
Also the regular version of both of those sites.
Yes, of regular Twitter and regular Mastodon. I got on there recently because Twitter is a nightmare, a hellscape. But yeah, give us likes, tweets, and responses. We'll answer questions. We'll give you shout outs. We'll make fun of your totally wrong theories that I secretly have all the answers to, which is totally not fair. But I think that's our episode for this week. Well, we'll get back into more crazy, weird, wonky nonsense in the next chapter, and plenty of depression in next week's chapter. So wanna play us out, Weird?
You know, I'm starting to think maybe now that we have Scotch Tape in our inventory, that this might have all been a terrible mistake.